What questions remain? Yeah.
The one about the self.
Yes. Okay. So about the self. So we're always trying to figure out, who am I? And in Buddhism, you're mostly trying to figure out who you aren't. Okay. The idea being that, like I was explaining beforehand, ignorance projects a mode of being onto people and other things that they don't actually have. And so in terms of the person or the self, ignorance sees the self as something real, kind of concrete and solid and existing independently. I have my own essence. I am a, you know, there's a real me. There's not just a body and mind, there's me. Okay? And in actual fact, when we, you know, although this, the I, meaning the capital I, although that appears to us, you know, so strongly, when we ask ourselves exactly who is the I or what is the I, you know, because it feels like there's a real person in there, you can't really pinpoint anything. Okay? Because, I mean, it has to be, if it's findable, if it exists in a way where it has its own nature, then we should be able to find it in the body and mind, you know, which we can't. Or we should be able to find it separate from the body and mind, and we can't do that either. Okay, so then the only conclusion becomes that it doesn't exist the way it appears to exist. Now, before we even get to that level of investigation, there's even a coarser notion of the self that many of us hold to. And that's the notion of there being a soul. Right? How many of you grew up being told that you had a soul? You know, you have a soul and, you know, God does something with your soul. And so the soul, the idea of the soul is it's something permanent. It doesn't change, right? Yeah, it's permanent. The unchanging essence of you. Yeah, it doesn't depend on causes and conditions. Yeah, it just is. Maybe God created it or whatever, but it doesn't change. And yet it's the essence of who you are. It's something unitary, one thing. Okay. And it doesn't depend on causes and conditions. Yeah. And it certainly isn't, you know, the body, and it certainly isn't the mind. It's something different from the body and mind. So, you know, we have that idea, and very often we feel that inside. Oh, yes, there's a real me that exists in that way. Yeah. But if you think about it, okay, what exactly would such a soul do or be? Okay. Because first of all, if it's permanent, that means it never changes. So what would your soul do if it never changes, you know, and it's never influenced by anything external to it? Yeah? What would that soul do? What would be its purpose? Yeah? It couldn't think because thinking involves change. It couldn't feel because feeling involves change. It couldn't cognize anything because that also involves change. It couldn't do anything because that would mean it would change. So what exactly would a permanent soul do or be? What would it, you know? Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? So, like, what is it? Yeah. And then you say, well, it's something in here. I feel it, right? I feel it, my soul. So does that mean that if you split open your body, you're going to find your soul? Yeah. Can you split it open? Does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Hollywood made one movie about some years ago about this man who was reborn as the dog in his family, and they showed him dying and then his soul, like some kind of cloud-like thing, kind of left here and went over there and went kerplunk into the dog. Yeah? So does your soul have form like that? Is it something you can see? But if it doesn't do anything, it couldn't even go from one body to the next. Or if it did, it would be all the same to the soul. There would be absolutely no difference. And the soul couldn't feel happiness or sadness because it doesn't change. And it's immune to causes and conditions. Okay? So can such a soul really exist? Yeah. We have the idea of a soul, but does everything we think actually exist? No. Yeah. Okay. So that's a very, very gross idea of the person, some kind of real essence of meanness. And there's something very emotionally appealing about that idea. You know, oh, my soul, that's really me, you know, some core of me that is completely stable, unchanging, doesn't change. There's something very emotionally appealing, you know. Oh, I can die, but my soul wouldn't change. Nothing could really hurt me because my soul doesn't change. It's eternal and doesn't change moment to moment. It isn't affected by external things. So there's something emotionally appealing about that idea. But when you investigate, could such a thing possibly exist? Yeah? And you become really hard put to say exactly what the soul would be and what its purpose would be. Yeah? Can anybody think of a... Do you know exactly what your soul is? Yeah?
Isn't this the same as in Hinduism, the capital I?
No. Yeah, I mean, the Hindus talk about an Atman. Yeah. Buddhists talk about an Atman, non-self, non-Atman. Okay, so it's the opposite of Hinduism in this respect. Well, why he came to that conclusion is because of what we're, the kind of examination we're doing right now. Yeah? What, you know, what would such a soul do? What would it be? What, could you isolate it? Can you find something and draw a circle around it and say, that's my soul? What are you gonna posit as being a soul?
No.
We talk about reincarnation, or actually rebirth is sometimes a better word. So we talk about rebirth, but there's nothing that is permanent and that exists in and of itself that is reborn. Okay. I find the example of a river very, very helpful here. Where are we? New York. I have to make the example according to where Hudson River. Okay. So Hudson River. Yeah, we say there's the Hudson River. And we all know where the Hudson River is and we all know what it is. That's no problem. Okay. But exactly, if we ask ourselves, exactly what is the Hudson River? And can we draw a line around something and say, this is the river? Then what are we going to draw a line around? Okay. Is the river the banks of the river? Is the river the bottom of the river? Is it the water? Is it upstream, midstream, downstream? If you have to identify something as being the river, you can't really pick one thing and say, this is it. Yeah. You come up with many things that are part of the river. And when our mind puts all those parts together and then thinks, oh, there's one thing and we're going to call it Hudson River, then we see Hudson River. But without that conceptual process and labeling process, without all of those parts, without all the causes and conditions, there's no way that you can find something that is the Hudson in and of itself out there. And yet, the Hudson River, if you drop a leaf in it upstream, it can carry the leaf downstream. And the river is there. But it's not the same from one moment to the next. So in the same way, you know, the mind, the definition of mind is clarity and awareness. So there's a continuity of clarity and awareness from one moment to the next. And it perceives, it feels, it cognizes, and so forth. Yeah. But is any of those moments of clarity and awareness what is reborn? No, because no sooner has a moment of clarity awareness arisen than it's also going out of existence at the same time. Okay? So the idea is when we don't examine all these things function, and just as the river can carry the leaf, you know, from the top here, the leaf is changing moment by moment, the river's changing moment by moment, but there is some continuity of both, even though you can't find anything that's really the leaf and you can't find anything that's really the river. So in the same way, you can have karmic imprints that come along with the mind, but they aren't physical, they aren't anywhere. And the imprints are impermanent. They're changing. The mind stream is changing. Yeah. Okay. So when we don't examine, conventionally speaking, we say, oh, there's a mind stream or there's a river. But when we examine with what's called ultimate analysis to try and find out what really the thing is, you try and get it, and you can't. Okay? So the idea is there doesn't have to be some truly existent or self-existent thing to be there in order for rebirth to occur. In fact, if there were a permanent self, such a thing could not be reborn because something that's permanent cannot change. And going from one life to the next life involves change. Okay. Yeah.
This always, on some level, makes me feel queer and wildly confused. Going through the intermediate state into the rebirth.
Yeah, There's something there.
There's something there.
Yeah. it's there. The essence of that person. That is, it doesn't change. That's how strong our grasping is, that we believe that that exists. Yeah, there is the fundamental innate mind of clear light that does exist, but it's changing moment to moment, and you can't isolate one moment of it and say that's what it is, you know, and it's something that arises due to causes and conditions. Okay. Yeah.
So what I'm struggling is if we view the self, I understand why we don't want to view the self as this inherent thing because it causes attachment and aversion and all these choices. But then I'm thinking, even when I think of, you know, us as aggregates and they're changing and impermanent, I still feel there's still attachment, you know. So to just pick a silly example, like a good cup of coffee, you know, I still want it. Like, even if I understand that I'm impermanent and everybody else is impermanent, I still don't like light.
Yeah, okay, so I'm impermanent, the coffee's impermanent, but I still want it because it has happiness inside of it. And if I drink it, that happiness is going to come inside of me, right? Okay, our understanding of impermanence is stuck in our head. It's an intellectual understanding of impermanence. Okay, we can understand a lot intellectually, but that doesn't move what's going on in here. Yeah? Oh, yeah, it's all impermanent, except me. You know, there's a real me that's not going to ever disappear. And even when I die, there's going to be children, you know? Yes, I'm going to die, but I'll still be children. I'm still going to think in English. Yeah, I'm still going to think in English. And, you know, and I'm just going to go because there's a real me, and it's going to just kind of trot off, even though it doesn't have form, and, you know, go into some other body. Okay, that's how deep our ignorance is that we hold on to that notion of ourself. Yeah, because when you actually search and like, what is this? You know? So this is, again, the reason why we need a lot of repetition, because we understand it here, but it hasn't gone down here. Okay, the same way we account for memory in this lifetime. Yeah, I mean, are you the same as you were when you were 5 years old? Do you remember things from when you were five? Yeah, but you know, you're not the same. Your body's not the same. Your mind's not the same. Everything about you is different than when you were 5 years old. And yet you can still remember what happened. Okay. So it doesn't have to be unchanging things in order for memory to occur. And in fact, if there were unchanging things, then the past never would have ceased. And we wouldn't even be here right now. Because the past would be permanent. Okay. Because anything that has its own essence independent of everything else is not affected by causes and conditions. Yeah? And that means it can't relate and change to any, you know, in response. And everything we do, you know, if you move, your body's changing. What if you think one thing to another, your mind is changing. Sometimes we have this idea of, okay, yeah, I get it. The mind is changing, but inside all that mind that's changing, there's still me that's permanent. Yeah, we have that idea, don't we? It's like a feeling, you know, there's still in me. I know it. So all this stuff is changing. But when I die, there's still that thing, you know? Still going to be children, still going to, you know, have the same personality, think in the same language. Everything about it's going to be the same. But what is the same about us from yesterday till today? Yeah? Is there something about you that is exactly the same today as it was yesterday? Yeah? The desire for existence, we call this a continuity of a similar type. The desire for existence is a mental state. Yeah, there's one moment of mind following another moment of mind. They are not the exact same moments of mind yesterday and today. And even within the desire for existence, it's going to be a little bit different yesterday than today. Not what?
I say not if somebody puts a gun to your head. In other words, there's something that if you go after a cockroach or somebody puts a gun to my head, no matter what my mood is, I don't think I'm probably going to acquiesce. No matter what my mood is. So this change in my state of mind, there's a continuity.
But a continuity is different than something being permanent. A continuity means that one, there's a continuity of something of a similar type. Something is similar to the preceding moment. There's a continuity. When we look at the box of tissues, it may look the same from one moment to the next, but actually the box of tissues is changing, isn't it? Yeah. So just because something seems the same one moment to the next doesn't mean that it's not on a moment, you know, on a very subtle level, changing. Okay. Yeah.
I've been grappling with the Buddhist concept of rebirth for a long time, and just having this conversation over lunch, actually, that I'm not there yet. And, I think I had Buddhist idea confused with the Christian idea of the soul. And I think you're starting to point at some of the distinction that I've missed. I guess, you know, I didn't grow up a Christian, but the culture is definitely Judeo-Christian. I'm still confused that I've for most of my life I've felt on a gut level, yeah, I don't buy this soul thing. I never did. I wasn't brought up that way, and it doesn't resonate. It doesn't feel right. The metaphor I like the best is that spirit or universal mind is like an ocean, and there's a drop of that, sort of metaphorically speaking, in each person when they're alive. And I feel like when I die, that metaphorical drop will go back into the ocean. So what is it that would be, if it's not a soul in the Christian sense, what is it that is transferred over to rebirth, so somebody can say, this was my past life, but someone else says, well, that's their past life. Isn't that the mind and the ego thing again?
Okay, no, it's just the idea that something has a continuity. Yeah. There's a continuity of one moment of mind producing the next moment of mind. Okay. Now, can you say that that continuity is you? Yeah. If that continuity is you, then when you say, I'm walking, it means that the mind is walking. But our mind is not walking, our body is walking. Okay, the whole idea here is we feel like there's something really there. And we have all sorts of ideas about it. But when it really comes to asking ourselves, can such a thing exist? It's like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know? We were told there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Everybody believed it, almost. You know? And there's got to be, and we're sure it is, and here's all the things, and we're even going to go fight a war because there's weapons of mass destruction there, and we're sure, and there's evidence, and da-da-da-da-da. Just because we think something, just because we feel it, oh yeah, Saddam, for sure he made weapons of mass destruction, just because doesn't mean that something exists. Okay? This is difficult. This pushes our buttons, and it's supposed to, because this is the root of our ignorance. So if something does not jar you and make you feel uncomfortable about the discussion, then it's not, you know, the kind of our grasping isn't getting touched. And our grasping is going to fight back. Yeah? There really are weapons of mass destruction, you know? And look, we got all these other countries to agree with us. Everybody's on board. Yeah? Popular opinion does not make something exist. Yeah?
And yet, at the same time, there is this clarity aspect, right? There's still this, there's the emptiness, but it coexists with the appearance. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I guess that's one thing I've always, this non-duality, I've always, it makes sense at times, and then other times it's just like,
out the window.
Yeah, but how do you coexist?
Yeah. Okay, so here this is talking about the two truths, yeah, and the two truths, things appear, like people appear, the mind appears, thing, you know, the telescope or whatever it is appears, but at the same time something is appearing when you try and find out exactly what it is. Because it appears to have an essence, you can't find what appears to be there, so the appearance is false. Yeah, the appearance exists, but it's a false appearance. So it's like when you watch TV, or you look at a movie on your latest device. Yeah, it looks like there's people in that screen. And you respond to it. Oh, look, he did that, she said this. You get all emotional because it looks like people. But all there is a screen. And is it electromagnetic? I don't even know what causes all the pixels and different things. I don't know how it works. But all it is a screen and then some electrical something, something. Yeah? But it looks so much like a person. Yeah? And you can even look and it's like, oh, they're so handsome. You know, what? The screen is handsome? You know, the screen's not handsome. The appearance is there, but the appearance is false. Okay? So on one hand, you have an appearance, a false appearance. On the other hand, you have the fact that it is a false appearance, the emptiness of the appearance existing as a real thing, the way it appears to exist. And both of those are there at the same time, and they don't contradict each other. Okay? So if you have the mind, you know, the mind's nature is clarity and emptiness. I mean, clarity and awareness. But its mode of existence is that it's empty of independent existence, empty of inherent existence. And those two things go together, because you can't talk about the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind unless there's a mind that is empty. Okay? So the mind and the emptiness are contradictory. They are not the same thing. But one can't exist without the other. They're both there. Okay? Difficult. Good, thank you. Okay. What were other questions, things you have difficulty with? Yeah. But why not? Why do you love that child more than you love other people?
I misperceive that it's only directed at her.
Yeah. But I mean, what, because you say like my daughter, you know, or my child, whatever it is. If they got the baby switched in the hospital, yeah, even though that child wasn't yours. Yes. I think you're onto something there. Yeah. What makes it difficult? Well, maybe think about that, because I think that would help. You know, what makes it so difficult? Yeah. I might venture a little guess. A little guess. I've been a daughter. I haven't been a mom. But I kind of know how my mom thought. Maybe there was some expectation. Hmm. Parents, do you have expectations for your children? Does having responsibility for your child mean you can control what your child does? Yeah. Right. So you help them. Yeah. You help them. Yeah. But what about that child is you or mine? And why, if your child flunks their spelling test in first grade, why is that so much worse than your neighbor's child flunking their spelling test in first grade? Yeah, okay, so on a conventional level, you know. But even that, why? Why do you have to do something about your own kid? Isn't there a choice involved there? Yeah, so there's some kind of conditioning in there, isn't there? A legal schmeagle, you know. You know. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of expectation of you as a parent, what how you're supposed to relate to your child. And there's a lot of expectation you have for your child because it's your child. You don't have the same expectation for the neighbor's kid. Like she said, you have to do something about when your kid flunks their test. Because if my kid flunks their spelling test, you know, it means I'm a bad parent. I've neglected them. They're stupid. They come from my genes, so that means I'm stupid. I'm completely losing my reputation. My child is, you know, first grade, can't spell cat and dog. They're never going to get into college. You know, they'll never get into college. They'll never have a good job. When I'm old, they will not be able to help me because they're going to be living on the streets because, yeah? And your mind quickly goes into some kind of, you know, this is a big, huge tragedy and problem. Yeah. If the same thing happens to your neighbor's kid, it's like, don't worry, they'll learn to spell cat and dog anyway, there's spell check. You know? Just relax, you don't care. Yeah? What's the difference? What's the difference? Even they mixed up the kids and the kid you have isn't your own biological kid. And your neighbor, you and your neighbor had babies at the same time. They got them mixed up. Your biological kid is the neighbor's kid. Your kid is not your biological kid. But that's the kid you have the expectations on. And the neighbor's kid, who's really your kid, you know, it's like, don't worry about if they can't spell. Yeah, there's a lot of me in there, isn't there? Yeah? Have you ever noticed as soon as we label something mine or my, its entire meaning in the universe changes? Yeah? As soon as that one word gets put on someone or something. Yeah, the whole thing changes. Yeah. This is the center's cup. That's nice. I use it. I put it down. It falls and breaks. I'm sorry it broke, you know, but, you know, I'll replace it because I don't want to be a, you know. Yeah. So, but it's no big thing. You give this cup to me? Wow, look, this cup has the eight symbols, auspicious symbols on it. Can you see? Can you see the eight auspicious? And look at that color red. That is beautiful. I've never seen that color red on a cup. Yeah? And look, it has a top. Not like some of those really nice cups that don't have tops. This has a top. So when you make tea, it stays hot. Isn't this a beautiful cup? This is my cup. Yeah? So don't I kind of go up in your eyes, get a little bit slightly higher status because I'm the owner of this cup? Yeah? my cup. Yeah. Venerable Tarpa can't use it because she might break it. But she is my friend. So she is my friend. So, yeah, maybe I'll loan you the cup. It's okay. Yeah, as long as you remain my friend. Okay. But if you're no longer my friend, then I want my cup back. Okay. Then the question is what that nun said to this woman here. How about if you broaden that and felt that way about every living being?
Right. It's an opportunity to actually see compassion.
Yeah. So you have to open it up and you see the neighbor's kid. And can you train your mind to feel the same depth of compassion for the neighbor's kid? Yeah. But you have to spread it beyond mine. Okay.
Can you talk about practice, like when you're trying to spread that beyond your children?
Uh-huh. Okay. This is kind of relating to his question, because you're saying that, the teachings, when you apply them to the people that you know, being kind, having compassion, it makes a lot of sense and it really helps your relationships with those people. But then the idea of expanding it, to people that you do, even to friends sometimes, or acquaintances, or people you don't know, or what about people you don't like? It's expanding it bigger, 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 and at a certain point, our mind sometimes says, wait a minute, that's too big. That's too big, Yeah, I can't go that big. But this is a process of training the mind. Because if you think about it, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could go that big? Wouldn't that be spectacular? If you could walk out on that city and look at every living being and feel that same love that you feel for your own child, that would be amazing. Yeah. It's going to take time and training to feel that. Yeah, we have to train our mind to go beyond our comfort zone. Train our mind to go beyond what is familiar. Train our mind to go beyond me, I, my, and mine. Yeah, and it really is a process of training, so that's why we do these meditations, So for example, what I find works really well is to think, everybody wants to be happy and free of misery as intensely as I do. Yeah, everybody. Yeah, the taxi driver, person at the grocery store, the person who almost hit me in the car. Yeah, that guy on the video who's wearing the mask who beheaded James Foley. All of them want to be happy and not suffer as intensely as I do. And that's something, you know, we can understand that in our head, can't we? Intellectually, that is not difficult to understand. But to get it from here down to here, it's hard because we have a lot of bias towards the near and dear ones and a lot of bias against people that we don't like or who we feel threaten our happiness and our well-being. So to overcome that kind of bias, yeah, takes a lot of inner strength and a lot of courage and a lot of repetition and training. Yeah. Yeah. Because our mind instantly goes, me. I mean, because look at, what do we think about all day long? Me. Yeah, I mean, it's habitual, isn't it? Me. Everything me. It's all about me. So to try and start changing that, I mean, we're really dismantling a structure in the mind that's been there since beginningless time. On the other hand, wouldn't it be wonderful when we are able to dismantle it? Or even as we're dismantling it, and we're able to grow that a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more than we were the preceding year. Yeah, that's good. We feel good when that happens, don't we? Okay. So it's not impossible, but it's not going to happen without effort. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about compassion?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Since learning about this, I wanted to become more compassionate towards others and wanted to help others more. But then I learned about the 8 worldly concerns, okay, mm-hmm. And wanting to help others, for example, I'm an adjunct getting paid, I need poverty wages, right? Wanting to help out in the sense, but that's helping with the material want, mm-hmm. Okay? Or wanting to help a teacher gain material things. I've heard contradicting things. Mm-hmm. If it's not a dharma...
Okay, I get what you're saying. It's like, well, there's the 8 worldly dharmas, and yet we're supposed to benefit sentient beings, but if we give them those things, aren't we just encouraging their 8 worldly concerns? Using an object does not mean that you're attached to it. Okay? You can use the cup. If my nose is running, I need a tissue. If you give me a tissue, I'm really appreciative. It doesn't mean that my 8 worldly concerns are getting elaborated on. It's a practical matter of my nose is dripping. Okay? So, same way, you know, if we can help people on the temporal level to fulfill the basic things that they do need to be happy and healthy, that's very, very good. Yeah? What we don't want to encourage in the process of doing that is to encourage somebody to be self-indulgent. Okay? But using an object because you need it to stay alive or you need it for your family or whatever does not mean self-indulgence. We have a real tendency at the beginning to think that that wanting anything means we're attached to it. That's not correct, okay? The English word want or desire, you know, has two meanings. Desire is a good one here. You know, there's the kind of desire of like, I want that. I desire that. I've got to get it. It's going to make me happy. And there's the kind of desire of, I desire to be a better person. Or what you said, I desire to be more compassionate. There's a big difference between those two, isn't there? I desire to be kinder. That's a virtuous mental state. That's going to lead you somewhere, you know? I desire 3 more boxes of chocolate chip cookies. That's attachment. Yeah? okay, unless I desire three more boxes of chocolate chip cookies so I can give them to these other people, you know, and give them a little bit of good cheer. So wanting things, yeah, in and of itself is there's nothing wrong with that. You're helping them on the short term, okay? For example, I mean, anybody who wants to practice Dharma, they need food to eat. If they don't have food, they're not going to be able to practice. So you're helping somebody in that way is enabling them to practice. If even if somebody's not a Dharma practitioner, you know, if you're able to help them, maybe you will prevent them from committing a crime, which would be beneficial for them and their family. Okay, so that kind of help is good, you know. It's temporal help, but it is good. The ultimate kind of help is when we're able to lead people along the path and teach them the Dharma and teach them about karma and ethical conduct and bodhicitta and concentration and wisdom. But before people are going to be interested in that, their basic needs have to be met. And also, some people are not really going to be interested in a spiritual path no matter how much you talk about it. They're going to go, where's the cake? You know? Okay? So you benefit those people just by being a kind person. And they know you're a Buddhist, and they may say, oh, I have a friend who's a Buddhist who's really kind. I'm not interested in Buddhism, but it must be something good because this person's kind. So they have some good seed planted in their mind, which is helpful for them. Okay. So saying ethics are only relative. Ethics are dependent. Okay. I don't think that necessarily means that there's no good and no bad. Okay. For example, when we start learning about karma, we learn that the Buddha, how something came to be called virtuous or non-virtuous is not because the Buddha made up the rule and said, thou shalt not do whatever. Okay. It's because the Buddha could see when people are experiencing happiness, yeah, these are the kinds of causes they created in a previous life that are bringing the result of happiness. These kinds of causes we're going to call virtuous or wholesome. When sentient beings experience suffering, the Buddha can see, you know, through his powers, what kind of causes, you know, that person created, what kind of actions they did that brought on that suffering. He called those non-virtuous or unwholesome actions. So virtuous and non-virtuous are established in relationship to their karmic result. Yeah. And happiness only comes from virtue. It never comes from non-virtue. And unhappiness only comes from non-virtue. It never comes from virtue. Okay. So you see, happiness and suffering are dependent on their causes. But it doesn't mean that everything is relative. And if I just wiggle my mind around in the proper way, I can say, oh, yes, killing is fine. You know? Or stealing is fine. There may be certain instances, very rare instances, where maybe taking life or stealing or something may, you know, bring about a good result. But there's some debate about that. Some people say, okay, maybe if you have total compassion, that can happen. Other people say, actually, even if you have total compassion, it's still going to require some kind of harshness at the moment of doing the action. So there's still going to be something negative, but you have so much compassion for the other people that you're willing to experience the suffering resultant for the benefit of the other people. Okay. But we have to be very careful here, because some people don't understand things properly and they go, oh yeah, everything's empty, there's no good, there's no bad. Yeah. I'm doing crazy wisdom. Crazy wisdom is indeed crazy. Yeah. If done by people who are ordinary beings, yeah, whose minds are untamed. Okay. So some things, some ethical things depend on culture. Yeah, they're going to have a cultural perspective to them. For example, yeah, in Tibet, it was very common for one woman to have many husbands. This is a way of passing down property in Tibet. Yeah, if many men, many sons had the same wife, then the land all stayed, you know, together. Yeah. So in their culture, yeah, that's fine. In our culture, it's not going to work. Okay. So things like that, depending on the culture and how it looks at things, you know, that kind of stuff is relative. But other things, you know, it's going to have the same result. If you harm another living being physically, it's going to have the same result no matter what culture you're in.
Mm-hmm.
I have a practical meditation question.
Okay.
Mindfulness of sitting and concentrating on the breath, and that concentration serving then as a way to sort of see where your mind is working, or even with a lot of practice to see things that have been repressed,
to what?
Things that have been repressed for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so two different kind of styles, seems like. One is just watching the breath, and whatever comes up, comes up. And you may have repressed memories, you may have who knows what come up. And it arises and it goes, unless you decide to psychologize on the cushion, which many people do. They don't arise and let it go. They arise and then, you know, go into, you know, my family background, the way I was raised, and, you know, what Freud would say about it, and what Jung would say about it, what my therapist says about it, and what the other person's therapist said about it, and is this something really good, and this has been a habit here, and, you know, and, you know, yeah, we can get really hooked into that. And then there's, but that's not genuine mindfulness when we start psychologizing. You know, the way it is it arises. Actually, well, the whole meaning of mindfulness is something different. Anyway, this whole style of meditation, you know, arise and let it go, arise and let it go. Okay, there you're really focusing on things being transient and impermanent and, you know, leading you into seeing that they're only thoughts and they don't have their own nature. Then there's another way where things arise and, you know, it's anger or it's greed or whatever it is, and you identify it as a non-virtuous mental state and you apply the antidote to that. Okay, so there's these two different ways. I think that it's helpful to do both of them. And sometimes you do them at different times in your practice. You know, both techniques may work. For some people, one may work better than the other. For me personally, okay, at the beginning of my practice, there's no way an angry thought could arise and I could let it go. Yeah. an angry thought arose, and I was in there, and I got angry again, and I was telling that person off. Looking very holy, being very angry. Yeah? Because anger comes, and I'm in that story. You know, there is a judge, a jury, and a prosecutor all in my mind, and, you know, that person is getting sentenced to, you know, life without, you know, possibility of parole, you know. I just, like, sign them away, okay? For me to overcome my anger, I had to really start with understanding why anger is an erroneous consciousness. Okay? Why I am misapprehending things, misunderstanding things when there's anger in the mind. And that's a hard one. Because when anger comes in the mind, I don't know about you, but I relate to my anger as I'm right. What are you saying? There's something erroneous in my way of talking. I am right. This person did this, and any red-blooded human being would be furious at somebody who acted this way. And I have every right because he did this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and this, and this. And I mean, isn't that outrageous? And I am, my anger, I am seeing it completely, realistically, for what it is. You know, this guy is a beep, 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 and I never want to talk to him again in my life. And, yeah? I mean, the bottom line is, I'm right, he's wrong. And if the situation is going to change, it's because he realizes he's wrong. And he apologizes to me. Yeah, because any other way, then he's going to walk all over me. And I got to stand up for myself. Okay? So, yeah, so this is the way my mind works. There's no way I'm going to say, arising, falling, arising, ceasing. No. Yeah, I have to go in there and say, why is this an erroneous consciousness? Yeah? Why am I misapprehending things? Why? What is the reason? What are the disadvantages of being angry? And is there a more realistic way to see the situation than how I'm seeing it? And for me, I had to, you know, spend long, long time going into all these things, you know, and really proving to myself the disadvantages of my anger and how I am misperceiving it. Yeah? He did this, 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 this. Isn't he an awful person? I created the karma. Why is he doing all this to me? I created the cause. But he did. I created the cause. Yeah, and coming back, and it's like, you know, I cannot, if I keep doing this, I cannot find a justifiable reason to be angry at the person. Yeah, so for me, I have to really prove to myself that. And then, arising, ceasing, then I can watch the energy come and go later on without buying into it. Okay, but this is kind of my personality. But I think the analytical part is important because one danger there is if you do the arising ceasing technique incorrectly, you wind up not really acknowledging things. Yeah? It's just like, okay, anger comes, anger goes. And you think, okay, I arose, it ceased, it's gone. But then it comes out in some other way. Yeah? So I think, you know, to really do just the arising and letting it pass, you have to be pretty astute. That's my personal opinion. Okay?
Yeah.
But if you say,
that then self-blaming?
No. No. Saying I created the cause does not blame myself. I think the word blame should be eliminated from the English vocabulary. Yeah? Because I think the whole concept of blame is not realistic and not very helpful. Because the idea of blame is there's one cause behind something. Yeah, it's that person or it's me. Is there ever just one cause behind anything that happens? No. You know, there's never one cause. There's always a whole multiplicity of different things. Yeah? So blaming someone else, blaming myself, any kind of blame is really unrealistic because there's never just one cause. Yeah? And I think, like, if I say, but I created the cause, yeah, then I have to be responsible for my actions. And if I don't like this kind of result, then I need to be more careful with how I act so I don't create the causes in the future. So this means I have some responsibility and also some power to change my situation. And it's blame. I'm not blaming the other person, and I'm also not blaming myself. I'm just owning what the causes are. Yeah? And then choosing, you know, do I want to continue to create these causes or not? Okay. Okay, yeah, so the question about tolerating others who have different views, even in your own tradition, yeah? And that's important. This whole issue, you're speaking about the Dzogchen issue, and Dzogchen, from the perspective of His Holiness, is a spirit who does not have realizations. But, you know, from the viewpoint of other people, they see this not as a spirit, but as an emanation of the Buddha. And so in the next few days when His Holiness is teaching, there may be some of these other people out in front. I was just in Hamburg at the end of August, and I've been in New York when they've been demonstrating before, but they were screaming at the top of their voice and beating drums and screaming, Dalai Lama, stop lying. And I was puzzled, what do they think His Holiness is lying about? His Holiness is explaining how he sees this particular practice, which he sees as something harmful, in the sense that people have the tendency to propitiate this particular spirit or protector, whatever you want to call, and as if it was an external being that was going to protect them and bring them wealth and do things for them. And His Holiness sees this attitude as something harmful for somebody really trying to cultivate the path, where you see that progress along the path is not about propitiating and pleasing external spirits. It's about transforming your own mind. And then somehow too, this particular spirit, I mean, it all seems very strange to us as Westerners, because some of us, we're not really tuned into the spirit world, but it's a very big thing for the Tibetans. But apparently the spirit is harmful to the government of Tibet, the government in exile, and wants to harm not only the Dalai Lama, but the government in exile. And so it becomes a big issue that's related to Tibetan, autonomy, Tibetan independence, all these kinds of things. So His Holiness is expressing his opinion. I don't know why. Personally, these people are protesting, because I don't see His Holiness lying. He is telling what he sees as true. And I don't know why they're accusing him of religious intolerance, because he's not stopping them from doing this practice if they want to. In fact, in India, there were some monasteries, in both Sera and Ganden monasteries, there were some people who did this practice and people who didn't, and they've split into two different monasteries. If you really want to do that practice and it means that much to you, sure, do it over here. These people don't want to do it. Okay? So His Holiness isn't preventing anybody's religious freedom at all. So I don't really personally understand what they're protesting against, because if they want to do their practice, they're very free to do it. And I'm very puzzled why, as Westerners, they're getting involved in something that is basically a Tibetan issue. The whole thing is quite puzzling to me. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I am so grateful for your response, but I'll follow it up with, mm-hmm. I was at Tibet House last weekend with Surya Das, Lama Surya Das, uh-huh. And I asked basically the same question, although it might have come out differently because he has a different personality, et cetera, et cetera. We're both New York Jews, et cetera. And I was shocked that your response comes out actually being very kind of neutral or matter of fact and historical almost. He basically said, they're a cult. And that, and those words, you're talking to a New York liberal, I said, whoa, and so I said well, what do you mean as a cult? And he said, A, B, C, D, and E. And I said, well, hey, who am I? I don't know, but from what I see, they don't have any of that stuff that you're saying. And then someone from the audience screamed at me, you're attacking the teacher. And here I am at Tibet House and in New York City, in the nation where we have laws about being able to speak freely of all places. And I said, of course this is all my karma, I get it, but I said, with my stomach shaking, I said, I'm not attacking the teacher, I'm inquiring. I'm inquiring. This is Dharma. They do this in the Dharma. Yeah. Could you please, and again, you just did a beautiful thing about he did this and she did this, but I'm sitting here mad or confused or scared or sad about Lama Surya Das, who's on the side of the Dalai Lama, whom I've been gifted tickets to on Monday, Tuesday. I'm scared that, frightened for tolerance sake and for truth's sake and for Buddhism's sake even, that someone, another teacher, unlike you, would answer my honest inquiry and say, they're a cult, while spouting out the other side of his mouth, oh, one this and metta and this and that. Mm-hmm. I don't expect you to say, oh, bad Surya Das, but I'm...
You know, different people speak differently about different things, and different people have different feelings about different things. And, you know, when you have different people speaking and answering questions, they will answer the same question in different ways. So don't take one person's answer and generalize it to the entire tradition. You know, he's speaking himself from his own perspective. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that everybody is seeing things in that way.
Does the Dalai Lama do you know personally or professionally if the Dalai Lama thinks of them as a cult?
I don't think he'd use that word, you know. He would say that propitiating this deity, you know, can be harmful to the cause of Tibet. You know, I think he would say that. And I think he would say propitiating this can be harmful to your Dharma practice. But it's a free world, you know. And it's very interesting in Hamburg. You know, they were demonstrating outside. And then there was an open mic in Hamburg, which usually it isn't the case. Apparently His Holiness wanted it. And one morning it started out with this man who said, you know, you are a student of Trichung Rinpoche, you know, who is one of His Holiness's tutors, a very highly respected Lama, you know, and he taught you this practice and now you deny this practice. Why are you breaking your guru devotion and not following your teacher? And His Holiness just kind of leaned back. He was completely relaxed. And he said, oh, you've heard just one side of the story. And then His Holiness was about to explain, and the other guy screamed, stop lying, Dalai Lama, stop lying, Dalai Lama, and wouldn't let His Holiness answer. Yeah, because His Holiness, he was quite willing to sit and explain his reasons for saying what he said. Yeah, so, you know, when it comes time for people taking initiations, he says, if you're doing this practice, don't come to the initiation. But for general teachings, he welcomes everybody, you know, but as a spiritual mentor, he has the right, if he feels that somebody is doing something that is, you know, opposite or you know, when you take initiation from somebody, there's a special kind of connection that is developed. And if the student has an angry mind and is calling the teacher a liar, that's not the state of mind to take an initiation from, you know. Or if you're doing the opposite of you know, the advice that the teacher gave, that's not the state of mind to take an initiation from that teacher in, you know. So he said, if you're doing that, then don't take initiation, you know. And you know, people do whatever people do. Yeah. So some people get really riled up about it. And I mean, you know, sentient beings are sentient beings. They do what sentient beings do. Not everybody who's a Buddhist is a Buddha. Not everybody who's Christian is Christ. You know, not everybody who's Jewish is Moses. Thank goodness. Yeah. So, you know, people do different things. Yeah.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
Somehow, through karma or what have you, I have found myself at some of their teachings, and but not even having anything to do with that dude.
Uh huh.
Whatever his name is, and the teachings are the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dangerous. I want to safeguard my own mind. For the benefit of all beings or for my own self, is it dangerous to even hear general teachings of the Dharma of impermanence? And
yeah. Yeah, this is one of the things that's so confusing about this whole thing, you know? And for myself personally, okay, the way I decided it is, because I have a very strong connection with His Holiness. I mean, quite, and He's, I want to follow His guidance. And also, actually, before this whole thing happened, back in the 70s, another one of my teachers, he said, "Do you do this practice?" And I said, "No, I don't even know what it is." And he said, "That's good, don't get involved in it." And this was another teacher that I really respected, who was absolutely an amazing teacher. And I thought, okay, I don't understand what he's talking about, never heard of this before, but I trust him, and so I'm not going to get involved. And meanwhile, my friends were all going off and getting involved, and I just said, no, thank you. And, you know, the way I've settled it in my mind now is there, for myself personally, is I've really seen there's a lot of power in who you make karmic connections with, you know? And you look around and like who... There was a time period in Buddhism where there was a lot of scandals. And my teachers were all like, no scandals. And I thought, wow, I am so lucky. And then I realized, well, lucky or somehow... In previous lives, I made connection with certain teachers that were really reliable, and I tried hard, you know, I must have kind of tried hard to, you know, follow their instructions, so I meet these same teachers this lifetime, and then, you know, I don't have to go through what some other people are going through with all their confusion. So I really began to think, oh, you know, you got to be careful who you make karmic connections with and what kind of karmic connections you make with people. So I thought, you know, you're right, you know, teaching about impermanence, selfless, sometimes very good, you know, even writing get very good books, you know. But I just decided that may be so. But personally speaking, because of this whole confusing thing that I really don't want to be any part of. Like my first teacher said, don't get involved in it. That's the way I want to be. I just don't want to get involved. So I don't want to create any kind of Dharma connection with these people that could wind me up in this kind of sticky, controversial situation. Okay? So I just thought, no, let them do what they're doing. You know, and I'm going my way, and that's it.
But you don't hate them,
I don't hate them. When people come to me and they say, oh, I'm going to that center, I'll say, you should know that it's a very controversial group. You know, and that's not the only reason, but I'll say, it's a controversial group, so you should examine things very well. You know, not just be blind. But I don't hate them. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say on this topic, because I've heard His Holiness speak many times because of demonstrators at various teachings, mm-hmm. and one of the things I really liked that he said was that, you know, that he himself did propitiate this deity, but then he realized that this deity would not allow him to accept teachings from other schools. Mm-hmm. And so he said, actually, I support sort of freedom of learning from everyone. And I thought that was so important.
Yeah, thank you. This is a point I forgot to mention. Thank you for bringing this up. The reason His Holiness stopped doing this practice is because that deity, that spirit or whatever it is, was saying you only can take Galupa teachings. You can't take Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya teachings or any other teachings, because that's destroying the tradition of Jay Rinpoche. And His Holiness, you know, he's quite broad-minded, and he likes studying with the other Tibetan traditions. And, you know, that was his principal reason, because he was saying that there was all this stuff going on, that if you practice other traditions, this deity is going to spite you or kill you or do all sorts of other things. And, you know, so His Holiness said, I don't want part of that.
Such a core part of Buddhism, as I've learned, that you, that the Buddha himself would teach the different things to different students, mm-hmm. and at different times for their needs. And it seems that maybe in the past, maybe it did make more sense, like when they were in Tibet and they were still, you know, you could maybe stay in just Gurupa teachings, and maybe that was good to keep. But now, I think His Holiness might be saying, in the modern world, we're a diaspora, we need to be able to take the other teachings. So I think on some level, it's what's appropriate for now.
It's appropriate for now. Actually, I think Tibet would have been better off if the people had been more open-minded in the past, personally speaking.
So even then. But I also think that the Dalai Lama is kind of the spiritual leader. And if he makes that decision, he's going to sometimes make an unpopular decision. So for people to call him a liar, it seems that there's another motivation there from that side that seems to be a negative motivation.
That's why I don't understand what they're getting out of doing this. It's a big question mark to me. Yeah, because they're Buddhist and they're making Buddhism itself look quite bad. So why are they doing this? It's really a puzzle. I don't know. Yeah.
This is a change of subject.
Okay. You have to ask a statistician. I didn't study that.
I mean, do we have as a practitioner, as a lay, do we have a possibility of a human life?
I think the thing is, we listen to the teachings. What are the causes for a precious human life? What are the causes for lower rebirth? We look at our behavior. We see what kind of causes have I created more of, you know, and then we decide from there what we need to do.
No,
I can't give you a percentage-wise, you know. I interviewed all the people who were born in hell, and I asked them what they did. You know, no, sorry. Okay. So this will be the last question.
Is it true that Buddha remembered thousands of his own past lives?
And I think if you really remember that many past lives, for sure you're going to want to get out of cyclic existence. I think for sure you'll want to. Okay. So I just wanted to talk for a minute about the book, because I know there's going to be a book signing, right, afterwards. So, the book, Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. It's, you know, because His Holiness felt that it was really important for Buddhists of different traditions, you know, in China, Korea, Thailand, Laos, all the different traditions, to know more about each other's teachings. And His Holiness has this perspective of, let's see our commonalities, but we also have to recognize our differences. So to get along doesn't mean we need to say that everything is the same. We can respect each other, you know, also because we have differences. So the book really points out a lot of the, it goes into the teachings. It's not a fluff book. Oh, yes, you know, our altars look different, but we all have Buddha statues, and we bow different, but we all bow. It's not like that. It's really going into depth into the teachings. Yeah, you know, refuge and the four truths seen as true by the Aryas and the three higher trainings and the six, you know, perfections. And going into those and seeing, you know, how are the teachings, you know, in common, and what are the distinct positions, not positions, views of the different schools. And so it's really, it's quite broad in that way, you know. And I, my real hope is that it will bring Buddhists from different traditions to not only appreciate the different traditions more, but to appreciate the Buddhist skill as a teacher, that he taught many different things because sentient beings have many different dispositions and ways of thinking. So for me, working on the book and having to do the research in many of these areas, I just came to have a much higher regard for the Buddha because of the diversity. Yeah. Okay. Yes, we thought at Srivasti Abbey, we have, first of all, you're all welcome to visit us. It's on the other side of the country, but I came here, so you can come there. okay, and I hope you have an easier plane ride than I have. But there's some verses from chapter 10 in Shantideva that we chant to a melody that you will all know. And we thought that since this is the Shantideva Meditation Center, we should teach you how to chant that and teach you the melody. Okay, so can we put the words on? Oh, no, you have them in your book. Yeah. So Venerable Sumpton's going to lead.
Well, all the nuns are actually...
You're going to hold the mic.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's make sure that we don't.
So I need you with me. Mm-hmm.
May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, come it evil or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water, find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May all who are ill and injured quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the May these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other for as long as space endures, and as long as living beings remain. Until then, may I to abide, to dispel the misery of the world.
So, thank you. It's good, isn't it? To purify that song that is so violent? Yeah? Yeah, the song is so violent, and to really, you know, change that. Okay, good. So thank you all very much for coming. And anybody who can go to His Holiness teachings in the next few days, please go. It is really worthwhile. He's quite amazing. Yeah? And come out and visit us.